So, Thomas, we look forward to hearing from you.
Sorry to interrupt, but we actually need more than just like 10 seconds. It takes about 30 seconds to stop the stream and then to get it back going again. So we need just like 30 seconds.
No problem. We'll pause, and if you can give us a hand wave or an indication when you're ready to go.
We're good to go now.
We're good to go. Thanks. Right, thank you. Over to you, Thomas, on the IGO PDP.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and I'm cognizant of the fact that it's me between the council and the audience and your lunch break. But I guess that the subject that we're discussing now, that we're about to discuss, is of great importance. Some, you know, and I'm hearing this over and over again, some think that this is a minor detail. They say, well, why are you talking about these few designations so long? Just give the organizations their names and we can move on to more important subjects. But in fact, as you will hopefully appreciate after I have made my short introduction, you will see that the level of complexity on this question is astonishing and that this is a huge minefield and that there are a lot of concerns at almost every single step that we're discussing. The working group is working very hard on these subjects. As you know, we have started a couple of months back. The council has started the PDP at its last meeting, or in October, I think it was. And since then, we have had weekly two-hour telephone conferences and further exchange of thoughts on a mailing list. To give you a little bit of background, and I'm not going to dwell on this for too long because you may or may not have heard that. Our charter was to look at whether there's a need for special protections at the top and second level for IGO and INGO names in new GTLDs as well as in existing TLDs. So the outcome of the PDP might be a consensus policy, which, as you know, will be binding for the existing TLDs as well. And should we determine that there is a need, we should look at the current special protections that have been granted by the board as provisional protections and see whether those should be made permanent or whether additional or other recommendations should be developed to provide for an appropriate level of protections. We thought that it was adequate for the group not to base its decisions or recommendations on our own thoughts or interpretation of law. As you will know, treaties and national laws have been cited to base protections upon, and the board, as well as the GAC, have claimed that there are legal and statutory protections that are the basis for the provisional protections. But the group was uncertain as to whether we should actually do the determination of what should be, how the law should be read itself. So we asked General Counsel to enlighten us about this, and in particular to find out for the group whether there is any jurisdiction in which a statute, treaty, or other applicable law prohibits either both of the following actions by or under the authority of ICANN: the assignment by ICANN at the top level, or the registration by a registry or a registrar accredited by ICANN of a domain name requested by any party at the second level of a name or acronym of an intergovernmental organization, IGO, or an international non-governmental organization receiving protections under treaties and statutes under multiple jurisdictions. Now, this is important because if there were laws that would prevent ICANN or registrars or registries from allowing registrations of certain designations, then it would not very much be a policy matter, because then the law would prohibit these actors from allowing certain registrations from happening. But then it would be more a matter for compliance to ensure that the players are actually not infringing applicable laws. Now, we've been waiting for general counsel advice for a couple of months, which was unfortunate, but as you can see from the time it took general counsel to come up with a response, you can see that it wasn't very easy for general counsel to answer. And that, I think, is good evidence showing that what we're talking about is not a thing that you can easily answer by yourself. So in essence, general counsel said they were not able to look at each and every jurisdiction in the world. So they were looking at a couple of jurisdictions. I think it were 20 jurisdictions, and Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was 20, in the ICANN regions that general counsel reviewed. And the result of what they said is basically that only two laws were identified which would make it illegal to register certain names. And in this case, it was IOC and FIFA in Brazil. And in Mexico, the unauthorized registration of a domain name using the IOC name was prohibited. All other laws or treaties that general counsel reviewed with the assistance of external advice did not explicitly prohibit certain these designations from being registered. Now the question was, what do we make out of that? Because it would have made our work possibly easier if it were illegal for contracted parties or ICANN to allow certain registrations. And now we're faced with the challenge that the law does not confirm what certain people that raise their voice in the process try to make us believe, i.e. that there are absolute rights. So that was not confirmed. And the question is, and I think that this adds a lot of complexity to our discussion, is how do we make the best out of that in the best interest of everybody? We have free speech issues versus the aim, and I think that everybody in this room will subscribe to the fact that we do not want abuse to take place, right? So if there is a catastrophe and the Red Cross the Red Cross designation is, for example, used for fraudulent activity, that's nothing that we want to see. But at the same time, if you look, for example, at the sixth chair list, which is attached to the Paris Convention, and which is the legal basis for IGO protections, that, for example, would only prevent commercial use of certain designations. So we can't easily say there should be absolute rights, but at least there would need to be exemption procedures to allow for legitimate third-party use. I gave the example of the sixth tier list. Another example would be designations such as Olympic Paint, you know, or Olympic Airlines, which have identical names with the International Olympic Committee, but still these designations can be legitimately used. And how do we provide space for legitimate use? So there is a lot of balancing to do in this, and you will see that there is even more complexity to this. So in our deliberations, what we were discussing is to find out how many of these organizations are out there that should be protected. So is it a couple of hundred? Is it a couple of thousand? Is it hundred thousands of designations that we're talking about? You know, what is the scope of existing protections under international treaties, laws, and so on and so forth? That's what General Counsel thankfully answered for us. We need to talk about qualification criteria. I'll get back to that in a second. And distinguishing substantive differences between RCRC, IOC, and other IGOs and INGOs. Because, you know, when we started our work, I proposed to the group that we should try work on a set of criteria that would be a one-size-fits-all, because that would be easier, but we certainly found out that this is nothing that would be a solid basis to move forward. So we had to split our activity and discuss each of these four categories of organizations separately. As at least the council members will recall from the briefing that I gave to council a couple of months back, we tried to slice our work into different areas. You will remember that both the GAC as well as the board have tagged this PDP a case study. And so if you look at these five areas of work, one would naturally think that you would be working on those one after the other, but that might be too time-consuming and take too long in the long run. So we chose to work on the various areas in parallel, and we created subgroups to do that. So the first group dealt with the question of the nature of the problem. There were some that said, is there a problem? A lot of the abuse that we see going on is not taking place by using exact matches of the names and acronyms of these organizations, but of similar strings, which is, you know, at least some would say, which is not in the mandate of our charter. So we might work on something that doesn't really address the problem. Then we were looking at qualification criteria. We can't just say, okay, we like these organizations or certain organizations, and so we're going to give them extra protections. But this is a very difficult subject, because we need to make sure that we don't open the floodgates for each and everybody that has certain rights in certain designations that then also wants to receive special protections. So the question was, what qualification criteria can we define for these four categories of organizations to really make sure that, you know, only eligible parties can get access to protections, whatever these protections might ultimately look like. Then we talked about the eligibility process. You know, what do you need to do to show that you belong to the group that fits the qualification criteria? Then we talked about admission to protections. You know, should there be additional conditions that you need to meet in order to be added to the program? And then types of protections. So the best that we could come up with at the moment is the following set of qualification criteria. But I have to add the caveat that some said that we should not talk about, you know, qualification criteria for whatever protections we might consider, be they at the top level, at the second level, for identical matches or for similar strings, but that the qualification criteria should be matching the concrete protection mechanism or the area that we're trying to address. So that depending on the severity of the protection mechanism, you might need or ask for harsher qualification criteria. So if, let's say, if you only use as a protection mechanism some sort of claims notice that wouldn't prevent anybody from registering a domain name, you might ask for less harsh criteria rather than if you want to block a name completely from everybody to register, because it's less intensive, there's less impact. So it's, I guess, a matter of proportionality that we're having in mind there. So the first proposal that we worked on was that the organization needs to be international in scope and operations, and that the primary mission of such is of such importance to the public interest, so we have the public interest in there, that it receives multilateral or multinational protection, such as protection by treaty or protection in multiple national jurisdictions or inclusion in the ECOSOC list, and that some form of special protection for its name and acronym can be justified. Now, you see that there's already, you know, I hope that you have some questions when we go through those, but rest assured that a lot of thinking has gone into this. You might note that we have an or between treaty and multiple jurisdictions, and that is because INGOs, for example, are not created by virtue of treaties. So you would completely eliminate the INGOs if we were asking for an end there, international treaty plus national laws. The second proposal was pick one of treaty.int list, ECOSOC general consultative list, or maybe some other list yet to be discovered. So you see that we're still looking for more ideas there, and pick one of that you have protective laws in at least 25 nations, or that you have protective laws in and have protective laws in three countries in four out of five UN regions. So this is actually something which is almost brave by the group, because it took some time for somebody to be courageous enough to spell out a figure. You know, we were talking about multiple jurisdictions, but what is multiple jurisdictions? And the difficulty is always not to be seen to be arbitrarily picking a figure to suit certain needs, but that we are actually trying to define criteria that are as objective as possible. Now, the areas of concern, and we're going to look at potential recommendations that we're discussing, but the big areas of concern are preventive versus curative measures for protection. You do know that we have both of them already in the system. So we have a reserve names list, which is a preventative measure. So, you know, the names that are on the reserve names list can't be registered. And we have reactive or curative measures as well. So the URS or the UDRP would be curative. But the organizations asking for protections say that these curative measures are not good enough, because they might need, you know, these might only help them after fraudulent activity has already taken place. So they want protections that help before that help prevent abusive behavior, registrations, or use of domain names in the first place. So that's a big issue. So we have basically two camps, one of which says we're not allowing for preventative protections because that might open the floodgates for everybody else to ask for preventative protections. And they say that the curative measures that we have in place are already good enough. And I'll get back to that point as we move on. There's also difficulty in the need for different qualification criteria for different levels or classes for protection. You know, some members of the group have stated that they want different levels of qualification criteria for different measures, but they haven't yet come up with concrete proposals. So as a working group chair, I have the difficulty that certainly I'm trying to facilitate the discussion, but the group or the community has to come up with something that can be discussed. So we need ink on paper, or, you know, dots on the on the screen. People need to put substance to their proposals at this stage. I think it's high time to actually come up with more substance than in this area. Then we have divergent views on how to structure an exemption procedure for protection for protected organizations' identifiers. I mentioned to you that the Six Tur list, for example, prevents unauthorized or prevents commercial use. So the question is, how do we identify legitimate third-party users? So you need to set up a process for that. And the question is, how is that process designed? And we have one proposal on the table which basically says that if you want to register a designation that shall be protected, then you need to go to the organization that is the holder of this designation and ask for their approval. And others say, well, it's unacceptable that you need to go to these organizations and ask them, because if you're a legitimate user, you don't need them to approve, but you per se have the right, because it's either written down in law, or, you know, there is nothing in the law that prevents you from using a certain designation. So that's a very difficult subject to answer. Then we have divergent views on whether there is a need to demonstrate additional, in brackets, evidence of harm as a requirement to qualify for special protections of an organization's identifier. There have been some in the group who have claimed that if there is no problem, there shouldn't be protection. So we need to know that we are actually fixing an existing problem. So if, let's say, 99 out of 100 organizations that might be eligible for these protections never has faced any difficulties with cyber squatting or fraudulent activity, then we're not willing to grant these protections because we're fixing a non-existing problem. And the organizations, some of them, like the IOC and the RCRC, during the drafting team phase, which was which took place prior to the initiation of the PDP, they have provided lists of domain registrations, you know, monitoring lists. They have provided documents, and they said, okay, we've given you an awful lot of evidence of harm. But the other said, that's not enough. We think that even in these lists, there's an awful lot of domain registrations that are actually legitimate. And so we asked them, those who were asking for evidence of harm, so what exactly would you like them to show you? And so they said, well, we can't exactly tell. It's difficult to say. And the others say, you know, we've given you something, and we're not really willing to give you more without knowing that the list of your requirements is going to be exhaustive, because, you know, we're trying to avoid this moving target discussion, that we provide evidence and you say this evidence is not good enough. So there is an issue there. At the moment, the situation is that that those that are requesting evidence of harm have not really specified what exactly would satisfy them to address their concerns. And in the other camp, there are those who say, we've already provided you with evidence, that's good enough. And others say, we have protections by law, and the law doesn't ask us to provide evidence of harm, so why should we proceed this evidence to the group? So that's the situation that we're living with. And I, as chair, have encouraged both sides to maybe work together to find some middle ground there, because the mere fact that no evidence of harm is shown, or that it is not sufficiently demonstrated, might lead to the result that certain parts of the community will per se not support any protection measures. But nothing further has happened there, so I think that's the situation that we have to live with, at least for the time being. Now, what were the protection measures that we've been discussing? And this is the part where I would like us to be interactive, right? So please, if you have questions or concerns, please do voice them, because I think this is not just an update to the council, but it's an update to the whole community, which thankfully is represented here in great numbers. I guess the group would very warmly welcome suggestions that can advance our discussions. Because at the moment, the situation is that the camps are standing firm by their positions. So they're not really, you know, everybody's reiterating their positions, you know, like, we have the laws behind us, so please protect us. And the others say, well, you don't really have the laws behind you, so we're not willing to protect you. And nobody's coming up with very concrete proposals. So what I chose to propose to the group is that we're going to publish an initial report prior to doing a consensus call in order to get community input, and then take community input into our consideration prior to doing the consensus call afterwards. And we now have this little, can you see how thick this is? This is the draft initial report that we have on the table. It's not yet ready for publication, but we hope that it will be by the end of April. But we would be very thankful for any substantive constructive proposals. My fear is that we're putting an awful lot of time into this exercise and that we might end up with divergence. I'm not saying that I'm advocating one or the other outcome, but we might be facing a situation where we can't come up with an answer as an outcome, and whereby others take over. For example, the board just makes a decision, and then we have another case where we might be disappointed because we feel circumvented, or that we are too slowly coming up with our results. And I have stated to the group during the last call that this is a situation that nobody might be happy with. Those seeking protection, or at least some of them, might feel safe because the board has provisionally granted them protections. So they might say, okay, I don't need to advance this PDP too much because I already got what I want, or at least a variation of what I want. But this is for the first round only. And I think that both the board as well as the GAC will take good note of our deliberations and our work. And they might say, okay, it's not as crystal clear as we thought, so the provisional protections might not be perpetuated. So the organizations asking for protections might turn out to be losing their protections. At the same time, those who are against protections might lose an opportunity to shape the protections in a way that suits their needs better. So I think both sides, the whole group, is very well advised to work together constructively, but I think that we're at a point where we need a little bit of outside triggering or, you know, new food for thought in order to advance our discussions. So what we are discussing in concrete terms is at the top level, you know, you have to remember we're talking about the top level, we're talking about the second level, we're talking about names of the organizations, we're talking about acronyms of organizations, we're talking about different languages, we're talking about identical strings, and the Red Cross has even asked for a string similarity review at the second level. So it's, you know, there are a lot of areas that we talk about. Top level. First proposal, let's add the designations, you know, if certain qualification criteria are met, to the reserve names list. Might be an easy solution. The reserve names list is already there, so we can just add additional designations to it. The downside to that is that even the organizations that have asked for protections or other legitimate third-party users can't use them. And it would require an RCEP procedure, which is quite cumbersome, to get names off the list. So I guess that even those seeking protection might not be too happy with the outcome of that. But still, we have, you know, that's just a proposal on the table. But it's nothing that we have consensus on. But it's a less liked option. The other option is not to add top level protections because there are already safeguards in the applicant guidebook. So we have the string similarity review, for example. We have the possibility to object against designations or applications for TLDs that infringe upon parties' rights. So a proposal might be or recommendation might be leave it like it is. The top-level protections are good enough. But then the argument comes that filing objections might be too resource-intensive or too expensive for these organizations. So another recommendation might be that subject to certain qualification criteria, we would give these organizations a comparable status to the GAC or ALEC, who can use the objection tool without costs. Then we have another option, which is let's review it for the next round. We have an evaluation of the new GTLD program. So far, I guess at least for the top level, we have only a very limited number of conflicting. I think it's four in total. I think .eco is an IGO in Iran that has been challenged, and then we have the .uno application. But apart from that, you know, there are no big problems to be expected. So one might as well leave that to the evaluation whether additional safeguards are needed at the top level. Now, before we move to the second level, I want to ask for questions. And John, please.
Not so much a question. I wanted to give you a chance to catch your breath and to provide just a little context for your report. You're giving me the impression that the working group has chosen sides, which is a binary vision in my mind. Is that true? And is there some the GNSO has a pretty rich diversity in its organization. Is that diversity represented on the working group, and is it possible that some of the, if that diversity could be recruited to the working group, might help you work through some of the back and forth that you seem to be caught up in?
As to your first question, it's not as, you know, it's not as binary as it appears. So there is also some gray in the middle. But we have quite firm views for both sides. You know, there are those who say absolutely no protections. Then we have those who say by all means protections. And then there are others who say, well, we might consider protections if the conditions are restrictive enough. Because certainly the challenge is to make a demarcation of the organizations that can benefit from these protections versus everybody else that has certain rights. So we have an awful lot of questions on the table, and even the from question to question, the camps are changing. So it's a huge variation of views in there. And as to your question, whether the whole community is represented, I think that we have members from every group except for Mason is now an observer, so the registrars are also on board. But they haven't been for quite some time. But now with Mason, I think we have the whole community represented. I think I saw your hand first and then Brian.
I think this is sort of, this is Jeff Newman, this is indicative of part of the problem with working groups, that many people go into working groups with kind of view it as a lobbying, that they have to lobby their position and they're firm and they never want to move off. We need to encourage the group and maybe hear from members of the group and not just the chair as to what they're doing to work through the issues, as opposed to just standing firm and not, you know, again, it's not a lobbying organization. It should be a group that works through the issues, not a group that just holds firm on their position. And if all they're doing is holding firm on their position, then we need as a council to figure out what we can do to help them move along, or, you know, try a different tactic. But we can't allow the working groups to be just a place where people lobby and just hold firm with no incentive. I often think a lot of times there is no incentive for people to back off their positions or to work to the middle. And I don't have a solution right now, but it's something that perhaps we can ask some other members of the working group that are present to, you know, what their thoughts are.
Thanks, Jonathan. Just small remark. You might get the impression that everybody's not working in a constructive manner. What I'm displaying now is the status that we're facing now. For the initial couple of months, the group has been working. I guess we've made very good progress in defining how we can move on. We've come up with a methodology to approach the issue. You know, so a lot is on the table, but I think that we're now at a decisive point in time where everybody needs to play their cards openly and say to what extent they can compromise. And I think that this is something that needs to be one or the other triggered. Brian.
Brian Winterfall, IPC. Quick question. I wanted to go back that you spoke earlier about the research that was requested from the General Counsel's office. And I apologize if I missed this earlier, but I'm curious why the query that was given to the General Counsel was so narrow and requested that research only be conducted with regard to specific statutes or treaties that relate to domain names specifically. I mean, a lot of treaties and laws, when they were promulgated, didn't contemplate domain names, which I think is sort of obvious in the answer that you got from the question you asked. Sort of tracking the IOC and the RCRC debate, and frankly a lot of people who've been vehemently against protections for those organizations, that specific point about actual research being conducted in a manner that was unbiased and being presented about the level of protections that those organizations do have globally, I thought that was the research that we were going to finally sort of have done in an impartial way. And so I'm very disappointed in a way that it was really asked in such a narrow, narrow way, and we sort of lost the opportunity to finally have an organization step forward with that information.
Thanks, Brian. I guess there might be a slight misunderstanding there. The research that was asked for, or the advice that was asked for, was not specifically saying that we were looking for treaties or laws that mention domain registrations, because obviously most of the laws and treaties have been crafted prior to the existence of domain names. But the question was whether these, whether laws or treaties are in place that would make it illegal for registries, registrars, or ICANN to engage or allow for certain registrations. So that even, you know, the laws are general and abstract. So, you know, the question was whether those prohibit that. Is that very short? Because I have a queue?
Yeah, I mean, I could add to it because the request actually stemmed from the original working group and then was carried forward. So in the drafting team, the request was because we kept hearing the GAC and others say the law requires registries to do this. The law requires registrars. The law – and so the basic genesis of the whole legal research was, okay, let's test that out. Does the law really – even if there are protections – for these marks and jurisdictions, is it really a violation of law if a registry allows a third party to register the mark? That's the whole genesis, and that's why it was done on that basis. So it wasn't, you know, is the Olympics protected in XYZ jurisdiction or are IGOs protected? But it was more a narrow focus because that was what we were being told at the time was the law requires you to reserve the names or the law requires you to protect the names. It's a very different question. It's esoteric, but it's one that's critical and was critical to the registries and registrars in starting this whole thing.
Briefly, please.
So, because I thought the whole debate sort of the whole time was sort of, well, why are these organizations getting this special protection? And you know, there was the idea that was spoken about. I really apologize if I don't remember there being, you know, it's illegal for registries or registrars or they're legally bound or required to grant those special protections. I think, again, I don't think anyone's, well, I'm not surprised that the answer was what it was when you asked that question. But I thought the whole point was to demonstrate that there was a significant global threshold that was sort of met with the treaties and the laws that granted these organizations special protections beyond other organizations. And in sort of setting criteria to contemplate adding other organizations potentially to those types of special protections, I thought we were really looking to really try and demonstrate, okay, what really is the quantity of protections out there. And I feel like we've kind of missed an opportunity because you or whoever tried to prove like this very narrow point, which isn't surprising to me, but then we sort of missed the opportunity to really catalog what really is out there research-wise as far as what protections do exist for the IOC and the RCRC and how those compare to these other organizations and sort of looking forward and how you are going to add potentially other organizations in for protections.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Landry, is that to this specific point?
Something similar. I just want to capture... I noticed in your presentation you highlighted the two extreme positions, people who are against protection and people who want protections. But my own observation in the working group is that there are still some middle ground that there seems to be consensus. I can't hear you mentioning the mid-ground that we discussed, essentially in the areas of a trademark clearinghouse-like resource, like which you called identifier clearinghouse or something like that. Mm-hmm. I believe a lot of people subscribe to that. There seems to be consensus about that. In other words, a good number of people would like protection, but they don't want blocking. I remember that when the issue of blocking was mentioned, a good number of people raised objection to it. Mm-hmm. They don't want blocking. But they could subscribe to other form of protections, which is like the identifier clearinghouse that was mentioned. So you didn't mention that in your presentation, and I think this is quite useful. In other words, there is no strict objection to protection, but there is objection to blocking. So we need to get that right. So that we don't go with the impression that there's a complete objection to protection. Yeah. I think there's some support for protection.
Thanks, Landry. And I have tried to at least try to clarify that there are positions in the middle, but that this is discussed controversially. And the idea is like trademark clearinghouse like that will come on the next slides. I wouldn't go as far as tagging any of the recommendations as having consensus. I think that some are really close to divergence, and others might have consensus with strong opposition, but we should also not give the group the impression that we have consensus on certain subjects. I now have Evan. I know that Kieran wanted to make an intervention. Then I have Zahid and Joy. And Chuck.
Thanks. This is Evan from ALAC. And I wanted to go briefly back to the issue of harm, which has been a big issue within at large, and also to what you were saying before about how you thought that one of the things was necessary, that perhaps a stumbling block is the lack of a serious definition of what constitutes sufficient harm. And I guess I would want to come back with asking you of saying, well, if we took the effort to actually do this, would we not run into the proponents just saying, we've already demonstrated sufficient harm, no matter what you do, you've wasted your time. In some of the conversations, it's almost seemed like that, where some of the proponents of protection have said that harm has already been demonstrated, or it's implicit in what they're asking for. So when you come back and say that we need to come back with a definition of what constitutes sufficient harm, would doing that really get us past an obstacle, in your opinion, or are we potentially just wasting our time with a diversion?
Well, if you spend time on it, I can't promise that it won't be wasted, to start with. But I have encouraged the participants of the working group that have taken either side of the the one or other position, to have discussions amongst themselves to see whether there is common ground. You know, like, what can you give us? What can we ask for? And to see whether there's congruence of what the organizations asking for protections can easily provide, and whether that would suit the needs of ALEC in particular, because ALEC and NCUC have been asking for the evidence of harm. And my hope was that in, you know, direct discussions, that you might come up with a set of criteria that you could sort of come to an agreement on.
But if the
that didn't take place.
But if the proponents have already said, we've already given you enough evidence of harm, what's the purpose of coming up with extra definitions?
Well, that's the situation that we're having now, that we have those two sides, and both of them, you know, one side says, I'm not going to work on the criteria because the others are not willing to provide information. And the others say, we have provided information and we're not going to provide any further information. And I have encouraged discussion to come over that, and maybe encourage those that were unwilling to provide information to reconsider. And I would like to repeat that encouragement. But unfortunately, at least I'm not aware of any discussions going on in the background on that. Kieran, please.
Hi, thanks, Thomas. This is Kieran Malanchariuville. I'm here representing the IOC. And I wanted to just thank you, first of all, for all of your work. And everybody in the drafting team or the working group has been working so hard on this, and we express our appreciation for that. The first point I'd like to make is we want to renew our willingness to provide any additional information that would help regarding a demonstration of harm. And I think the IOC and also the Red Cross has done a lot of work on that so far, and we're willing to do whatever else you'd like. So any additional specific questions or definitions, you know, we would be happy. Obviously, I can't speak on behalf of IGOs or INGOs or on behalf of the Red Cross, but certainly we in the IOC are happy to present any additional information that you would want to help us reach consensus on that issue, which, of course, is a threshold issue. I also wanted to express our support of what Thomas said about the General Counsel request response, and just offer one point of clarification. I think that what our main concern was not whether or not it was an explicit violation of the law to allow for registration of these domain names, but rather does allowing these registrations provide a cause of action for the organizations to, which would expose the registrars, the registries, and the registrants to liability. And I think that part of why we're pushing for these protections is not just for the sake of the organization, but also to protect everyone in the chain of registration from kind of exposure to these causes of action, which I think the General Counsel stated that there was. I think that the quote was nearly all the sample jurisdictions provide protections to the IAC and or the RCRC for the use of names and acronyms, and those protections are understood to apply to domain names, and that there could be, as Thomas rightfully stated, exposure to liability up the registration chain. So I think that hopefully that provides some clarification for you, Brian, and also for you, Jeff, about what the reason why it was drafted the way that it was and the way that we're viewing the response. And I think our last point is we're going to sound a little bit like a broken record here, but I hope that this comes across very loud and clear. The IOC specifically has never stated that we have absolute rights in the names. The law does not give us absolute rights in the names. There are legitimate interests and exceptions, and we have always acknowledged that and are very willing to provide exceptions where warranted and where necessary. And that's why we've taken the lead and been very participatory in drafting the exception procedures. And where we say that you can come to the organization for a letter of non-objection, certainly that wasn't the sum total of our recommendation on the exemption procedure. We just think that might be the easiest and cheapest and fastest step for a registrant, especially in a situation where we understand the law and we know that there are people with legitimate exceptions. So we just, thought that might be an easy thing for the registrants to do, to come to us first, to the organizations first. And then, in the event that they don't want to do that or they're worried about what kind of schemes we have up of our sleeves, which we don't have any, by the way, but, we would, of course, then move on to something more structured from a third-party perspective. So I hope that adds some clarification as far as our position in the IC is concerned. And again, we're happy to continue working to move this towards consensus and to compromise wherever we can and to acknowledge and appreciate everyone's position on this. Thank you.
Thanks, Kieran. I have ended the queue now. We only have a few minutes left, and I'm going to take Zahid, Joy, Chuck, and David now, and then I'm going to very, very briefly show you through our thoughts at the second level. Zahid, please. Can I ask you to keep it brief, please?
Thank you. Just 2 points, one on the council advice and one on harm. On the council advice, I think, if I remember what you said, Thomas, was that, as a result of the advice, now we know that whatever some people were telling us that they had protections, and I assume you meant the GAC or the governments or the IGOs, we can now go back to them with this opinion and say, well, the council advice doesn't say exactly as, or is not consistent with what you had informed of. I think we have a problem with that, because if the intention was to go back and say, well, what are the protections in the law for these entities, linking does the law protect or does the law prohibit, and then saying registrar registries undertaking this, you're falling for the same problem, which is that registrar registries did not exist when these protections were created. So I think we're circling back to the same problem. I can tell you, and I've seen the, I think it was a draft memo or the memo of the council's advice. Sure, there were certain patchy assessments given in the subcontinent. It's a criminal offense to violate, say, the RCRC's marks, etc. Pretty much, I work with our CCTLD. If something like this happened and somebody lodged a criminal investigation or inquiry into it, you would have the law enforcement come to the registry's office and say, well, we have a complaint and this is the special law under which this is, you're not allowed to do this. Now, it doesn't specifically say domain names. It doesn't specifically say registrar registries. But basically, that's how it would sort of implement itself, because most of those countries in the world haven't got specific legislation on domain names or registry. I mean, if they don't have it on domain names, forget about registries being named. So I think it is a very narrow scope that was given maybe to council, and I do not think you can go back with that to in some way shame those people who said that they were, you know, that these protections exist. I think that would be, we need to be careful of that, you know, at least not using that as one of the tools. The second on harm, yeah, I understand that, you know, harm is useful to be a factor for providing protection. But the argument, as I saw you sort of developing, you know, this is what was happening in the groups, two groups there, was that, you know, despite the existence of a law, harm needs to be shown as a factor. It kind of reminds me, and I'm not from the U.S., but the debate on the voting rights. Well, there is no discrimination in voting rights anymore, therefore maybe you don't need a voting rights law. Maybe that's, you know, it's a circular argument. Maybe it's because the law exists that these harms haven't been seen. So are we going to have to come back here and say, well, now that we see harm arise, the GNSO needs to relook at this, or should we work on the basis of principle? Just my 2 points. Thanks.
Unfortunately, we have to take this offline, but I think that with the general counsel advice there, you know, we need to talk about that more. I think that there are some slight misunderstandings potentially. I have Joy now, followed by Chuck.
Thanks, Joy from the Non-Commercial Stakeholder Group. A couple of reflections just listening to your report back, Thomas. One is that, and thinking about the terms of reference given for the work that you're chairing, and thank you for your work with it. It seems to me from what you're reporting that there is no, for all the areas on which there is not consensus, there doesn't seem to be a clear message that the fundamental policy frameworks of the council around this are somehow broken. That, in other words, there is no particular... I don't hear you saying that there is a need for an entirely new approach across the board, that this is a quite specific issue to a quite narrow... quite narrow topic, and I think that's useful to hear. I think the other thing is just mindful of the conversation we had this morning about policy versus implementation. I'm curious about the feeling you're getting, for want of a better word, about the trajectory of consensus around this policy. I understand that there are some views strongly held, which are polarising, including some from some our own constituents, my own constituency group. But nonetheless, do you see any areas of rough consensus emerging? And secondly, particularly mindful of the last part of the terms of reference for this working group, the implications of this public policy beyond the narrow parameters of the particular organisations we've talked about this morning. Do you see any emerging consensus around what are the public policy issues that council should be focused on in choosing between these options? Because I think that would be helpful for guidance and advice, as if there's some kind of summary of what are the public policy concerns that are bubbling up beyond the specifics of the particular organisations, because if we're going to have policy that applies more broadly, I think that would be useful to know.
Joy, since we have some time constraints now, I will respond to those questions on the council list. Chuck, if you could keep it brief, please.
Sure, and I won't repeat what Zahid said, because he gave a little bit of background for the request that was made to the General Council, which was initiated from the Registry Stakeholder Group. And bottom line is, if the General Council's response clearly was not definitive with regard to international treaties and laws. It showed some good trends in the countries that were surveyed. If the international treaties and laws, according to the General Council's response, were definitive, then this would be a compliance matter. It's not. So, and none of us were terribly surprised by that. So it's just important that we have that context. And Zahid is right that some people in the GAC were saying, hey, why is the GNSO doing a PDP on this? The laws already cover it. And we needed that to set the stage there Not that that lets us off the hook. It actually, as Thomas said, makes it a little more difficult for us. But we now know from our source as a policy-making body in the GNSO that we can't just hang our hat on international statutes and laws alone. We're going to have to base it on some other criteria.
Thanks, Chuck. Dave?
Knowing that I'm the last person, everyone would like me to be quick. I just briefly wanted to comment on that issue of risk. We are always going to fail to find a solid risk that occurs from registration itself, in apart from a very small minority of cases where it's illegal to register those names. Most of the time, the problem, the harm caused from registration itself, in most cases, is going to be minimal. The extensive harm can be caused by the uses to which those names are put, but we don't necessarily know that until afterwards. The question of harm may be more relevant to post-registration solutions like APWG sort of takedown procedures. If we keep looking for harm caused by registration itself, we're going to be looking a long time. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking at we should be considering mitigation and risk exposure and so on for these things quite carefully, and hopefully that will be the sort of spirit in which those issues continue to be looked at. Does that make sense? Yeah.
It does. Thank you very much, Dave. And before we close the session, let me briefly go through the recommendations that are being discussed for the second level. Obviously, one could just add designations to reserve names list, but then the same problem occurs as at the top level, that these names can't even be used by the organizations in questions or legitimate third-party users. The other proposal is not to add it to that list, and maybe come up with an idea of something comparable to the TMCH. And in order not to use the TMCH acronym, we thought that it might be an identifier clearinghouse or something of that kind, a central repository where those qualifying for protections can have their names validated and entered. And then it would feed to the contracted parties. And one could talk about fees for fee reductions for the use of that, and actually base either a claims service on it. That's, I think, an area where we might get at least some support. I'm not courageous enough to speak of consensus, but since a claims notice will not prevent registrations from happening, I think that's something that that people might be going for. Those asking for protections might say that this doesn't go far enough, but that's yet to be seen. And one could make this claim service possibly permanent to give warning notices to those that are trying to register certain designations. The organizations in question would get these notifications once the registrations have taken place, and then they can choose whether they are going to do a UDRP or a URS. Then the question is certainly not all of them can use URS or UDRP. And we're now coming to another area where there's broad support, and we might even have something of consensus with a strong opposition, that we might recommend opening up the RPMs to all the beneficiaries of potential protection mechanisms so that these can use the curative measures. And then another proposal was that let's say there is a registration request. The registration request would be pinged against the ICH or the TMCH variant. And if there is an identical match to it, the registration request would be pending create. And then there would be eligibility checks for the registrant to see if it's a third part, whether it's a legitimate third-party user. And if it is, then the registration would go through. If it is not, the registration couldn't take place. The question then is, how shall this exemption or eligibility process be designed? And there, again, we're at a point of discussion where some say that approval is required from the organization in question. Others say that this shouldn't be the case. And then we have the more fundamental question of whether it is even agreeable that registrations will be put on hold for at least some time for eligibility checks. And we have some in the group that say that this is not acceptable because it doesn't allow for immediate registration and that this already harms freedom of expression and the use of certain designations. I think I'll leave it at that. I hope to have encouraged you to join the club, participate in our discussion. We're going to have a working group session on Monday. At which time, Barry, Brian, one of you remind us? 4:30 in which room? We can send that to the list, so please come join and provide your input. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Thomas. I personally just would like to add my own compliments to you for dealing with an exceptionally challenging subject. This is both challenging as a subject and challenging as to execute the work of the working group and sort of lead this group through. So you've done a fine job. I recognize, and as we all can, that there are a series of open questions, but the fact that you've distilled it down with the colleagues in the working group to the set of key questions, the set of issues and the set of questions that you have, to my mind, is an achievement in and of itself, and clearly we're going to give you the support and take your request for additional support or contribution to try and bring this to a close. My understanding of, for what it's worth, my personal understanding of the question of the question to General Counsel was there was a question mark over the legitimacy of the work of the group, of a PDP being undertaken, and to some extent, which I think is the point that Chuck was making, is that this was about ensuring that this wasn't an issue that was already predetermined, and that there are indeed a series of important questions and outcomes that need to be determined by the thorough work of a working group, which I understand is being undertaken. But there's clearly a lot more to discuss and run with this. We, myself and Thomas, are in fact going to have a meeting to talk with Heather Dryden, chair of the GAC, briefly, and for the next in 20 minutes' time. We're going to give her a personal briefing on the work of the working group, so I hope that'll be fed back to the GAC in to Wolfgang's earlier point. We will see what comes out of that and then obviously update the council. Now it's time for our lunch break till 1:30. We very much welcome obviously everyone who's in the room and encourage you potentially to stay for lunch if you'd like to, but if you could kindly give the councillors the opportunity to have a first opportunity. I know there's some sensitivity and we very much welcome and appreciate broader community input into the council's working sessions and don't want to be mean about sharing our lunch, but we do want to ensure that the hard-working councillors are fed. So thank you very much for a good morning session, and we'll see you all at 1:30.